the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Delighted to be joined for the Culture Club by David Kitt. You all remember The Big Romance. The 25th anniversary version is coming out soon. Let's just hear a little bit from the new version of From Hope Street. Big Romance is out next week, 25 years on from its first release. David, why have you re-released it and in what way is it different to the original release?
Well, it's different because I own it and Warner Music don't own it for the universe for eternity, which is the case with the original record.
Are you an Irish Taylor Swift here, are you?
It's coincidental. I'm not saying that she inspired me, but we definitely find ourselves in a similar boat. Obviously, hers is a colossal, exponentially greater financial situation. But
you had to go and get the rights back to your own album, essentially, is it?
Yeah. See, I own this publishing of the songs, so I'm free to re-record them. But Warner's, like, I signed a very silly deal, like a lot of people who are young and foolish and don't really read that you're supposed to have people who give you good advice in these situations. But unfortunately, I didn't. And yeah, it was, the copies of the original go for, 150, 200 euro on Discogs now. And I've never, at all gigs, people are always looking for copies of the record. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to go back and do it, try and do it again.
Did you do it any differently?
Yeah, like my voice has changed, but we really went forensic on, it was like a detective kind of thing, like trying to find all the original samples and breaks, and we didn't use any post kind of 2000 technology, and we're quite dogmatic in that regard. And even listening to it coming on there, I was like, oh, is this the original or the new one? And it's a lower key, but It's a future proofed key as well. I can probably sing it in that key for the next 20 years if I'm still around. So I don't know. Yeah, like certain boxes needed to be ticked in terms of people kind of just having a similar response to it or something. You know what I mean?
But you got Ken McHugh to produce it again, did you?
I ended up kind of being the main producer, similar to the first record. But Ken came in on the first kind of, he was a massive part of solving the problem. Yeah, and his work was huge on the first record. But there was just like Ken's kind of working in a different industry at the moment, and he's massively skilled musical engineer, but he's kind of on a laptop, in his house in Mullingar, and we were just sending files back and forth, and he really, really helped on this. But I kind of needed to push it a little bit further at the end. And, I've been making records for the last 25 years myself, so I kind of brought all my own knowledge in, and a lot of the stuff I've been focusing on, I suppose, are, it's a toolkit that my 25-year-old self would love to have.
Yeah, but did you recreate as much as possible what you had back then? Or did you change things on the basis of 25 years of experience thinking, actually, that song could have been better if we do this?
One or two little things like that, yeah. Yeah, like certain choices. But the key, like in many ways, I think, I've the end result shares more DNA with my very first release, Small Moments, on Rough Trade than the original record did. And I thought that was an important part of making it Kitzer's version or whatever it is, you know, which is what it's called. And yeah, I like the first three songs are very close. You know, it's like Hope Street, You Know What I Want to Know, and Step Outside in the Morning, like three of the key tracks on the album. I really did want, it became an exercise in, no, it's just not there yet. It's not there yet, you know, and really pushed it. And then, yeah, in certain places I had a bit of fun with it and maybe improved it.
But you've also added new songs on as well.
Yeah, I just want, there were three, with the singles, I wanted to have B-sides, kind of like we did on the original record, and I just decided to make them new songs. Yeah, and they fit thematically, you know. Yeah, it worked. And we had to fill out the vinyl, you know, because the original record, we crammed 55 minutes onto a single vinyl, so it's never sounded great, the original pressing. This pressing is 180 grams, beautiful matte finish, and we needed a few extra songs to kind of make it a proper double album, I suppose.
Okay, so are you hoping that people buy it in vinyl rather than streaming and that type of thing?
It kind of was all about the physical thing. Like, I sold 60,000 copies of the original record. There is no...
Sorry, was that in record or was it CDs?
That was probably mainly CDs. Yeah. But ultimately, you know, it'll be very successful if we sell 1,000 of this vinyl release. But it's something, I got the record back about 2 weeks ago and I'm super proud of it. You know, like, it really does sound good. It's a beautiful product. It's a premium product. And, you know, to show up at gigs with a box of those, you know, sell 25, it helps my innings for the night. And I think there'll be a lot of satisfied, you know, fans of the original record going home.
I think lots of people are going to love it. It's out next week. And that is The Big Romance. So David Kitt, and also you will be performing the album in full, won't you, around the country from next week onwards?
Yeah, well, the big ones are the Concert Hall, April 10, April 11. April 10 sold out and April 11 is getting there. So, yeah, I mean, that's a big result for me. It's, you know, it's a big upturn in fortunes from, say, 12 months, 18 months ago. So it's great, you know, it's all family, that, you know, family members are coming and all friends. And it's a bit of a reunion of sorts, I suppose.
Very good. Let's go through all your Culture Club choices. And what's the first single or bit of music that you can remember getting?
Well, I have a very vivid memory of getting this because we were staying in Kelly's Hotel on a family holiday. I was 11 years of age and I convinced my parents to... I was obsessed with music. I had, you know, early albums would have been Wham, Nick Kershaw, all that kind of 80s synth pop. And I asked them for, like, can you give me a fiver and go and buy something in the record shop? And I got directions at the hotel reception. I asked this old man, they said, it's down there on the main street. And I said to this old man, is this the main street? And he turned around and he said, imagine saying this to an 11-year-old kid. He was like, it is, and the further you go down, the mainer it gets. So I was like, whoa, I got it. I was like, oh yeah, I see what he's doing there. And so I went into the record shop with my £5 and bought, the Pogatry in Motion EP. My first ever album was Rum, Sodomy and the Lash by the Pogues from Santy. I had no idea what sodomy meant at the time. But I bought this single, Pogatry in Motion, which had a couple of new B-sides on it, you know, London Girl, and a couple of songs that weren't on the album. But Rainy Night in Soho's on there, which is, wow. I mean, what a first single.
One of the favourite Irish tracks, as we discovered recently in our top 100. Well, let's hear a little bit of it.
I've been loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days. And I've cried for all your troubles. Smile at your funny little ways. We watched our friends grow up together, and we saw them as they fell. fell into heaven. Some of them fell into hell. I took shelter from a shower, and I stepped into your arms on a rainy night in Soho. The wind was whistling all its charm.
That came in at number 3 in the listener's choice of the top 100 Irish ever songs, yeah. A Rainy Night in Soho by the Pogues. Although, David, there were a few people started laying saying, it's not an Irish song.
I don't know. I strongly disagree.
I think most of us strongly disagree. It's still beautiful, isn't it?
It's incredible. Years. What a songwriter. I mean, yeah, you know, he really struck gold, you know, at least 10 classics in there, you know.
40 years old. Okay, favourite albums. You were one of these people who just didn't plumb for one favourite album. You gave us quite a few. So tell us what you picked.
Well, actually, what's on the list there? I've got one in front of me.
Oh, well, I have four that you gave me.
Neil, I mean, I've gone with the one that I, the one, and I think you've correctly edited down. You've given me one here on my edited cultural club choices, and it's Neil Young, After the Gold Rush. Which I've played it more than any other record. It's like a comfort record. You know, there's a few in there like J.J. Cale, Naturally, in a similar vein. I think I put a Beatles album on there.
You did Revolver?
Yeah. And that's a constantly changing favorite Beatles album, but that's the one, Du Jour. And I think I put my Bloody Valentine on
there.
Yes,
and we'll talk a little bit more about them in a little while.
Yeah,
you also have Nas.
Oh, Nas Illmatic. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in, maybe it's to do, some of these choices are related to the Big Romance and records that, you know, Nas Illmatic was a big influence on the Big Romance. And when I went back to it even more so, just the machines that were used to make that record, old 90s samplers and, you know, that kind of hip-hop aesthetic, sonic aesthetic married with acoustic instruments was a big part of the Big Romance sound, you know, and... that's just, I think this, the thing that After the Gold Rush and Illmatic have in common is they have 10 songs and they're concise. There's no fluff. It's just, you know, they're beautiful side A, side B records. Great records on vinyl, you know, a really satisfying listen. And yeah, they'll always remain in my top 10.
Well, let's have a little bit of a listen to Neil Young from After the Gold Rush, Only Love Can Break Your Heart. Why do you always go back to that?
It's just so perfect, isn't it? It's just so economical. 35 minutes, you know, you're always left wanting a little bit more. And it's subtly clever. So, you know, like it's kind of like your favorite old pair of jeans or something. You know, it's just got that kind of just always works. You know, you kind of, it's a good morning record. It's a good record after a few glasses of wine. It's, you know, it's just one of those... you know, and just the fact that he's still at it, you know, and his voice still sounds amazing. He's still playing the guitar amazing.
And he's still a man with strong opinions.
He sure is, yeah, yeah.
Favourite bands, you've given us two. You've already mentioned them, but let's talk a little bit more. Your love of the Beatles, and you go from album to album, you say, okay, what is it about the Beatles for you?
I mean, I think they're kind of like alive as a favourite band because of the Get Back thing, which I've watched, like, I'd say 5-6 times now. I can't get enough of it. And it was, you know, it was like this Technicolor moment of, like, all these, this music that I had such an intimate relationship with, but in headphones or on speakers, you know, and then to see it come to life with this glorious footage and the clothes and the detail and just the fact that Peter Jackson's original, or the, what's his name, the guy who made the original, Michael Lindsay Hogg or whatever, you know, it kind of dramatized it and made it all kind of bitter and bitchy, and it just wasn't like that. To see that side of it as well, like they're just pals, all still in their 20s, that amazing conversation in the canteen between Paul and John, they're talking about George leaving, and it's like, you know, they didn't know the mic was there, and all these techniques that Peter Jackson, who's a massive Beatles fan himself, used to retell the story. You know, it's just really brought them to life again. There's, you know, and just the fact that they were together since they were like 14, 15, they'd been through so much by the time they got to Get Back, you know. And just all the mechanics of how, yeah, you know, I mean, I have friends that I've, Paul Smith, who's playing with me in the concert hall, first time we played together was when we were 15, you know. It's like, I love those stories of, you know, just the mechanics of how friendship and art overlap and how it can kind of get messy and spicy, and, you know, but the creativity at the heart of the Beatles, I suppose, is the key thing. It's the way that the hive mind, you know, the way they work shit out. It's incredible.
And what about My Bloody Valentine?
Well, again, it's a gang, you know, they're from Dublin, they're still together, you know, like the show in the O3 was, you know, I had friends who were at they did a kind of a live rehearsal show in the stadium the week before, and I had a lot of friends of mine were at it, and they were like, Jesus, I'd be worried if I was in the band, you know, it was a bit like messy or whatever. But the O3 show was just, it was perfect. Like the first three songs, you kind of have your hands on the edge of the seat. You kind of go, oh God, are they going to do it? It's like, you know, like watching your cousins or some, your kind of like indie cousins, or, you know, like they were such an influence on me as a kid, as a 15-year-old. But it was just magical, and they just feel like a gang, you know, they're not like virtuosos. Kevin Shields obviously is a guitar hero and a sonic wizard, you know, but as a band, they're still at the heart of it, a kind of an indie punk band, you know.
Let's hear from Loveless in 1991, Only Shallow. That sound, yeah. Although they were very early to it, actually. A lot of people sort of adapted that sound 100%, in the years afterwards.
Yeah, they really were pioneers, you know, like such iconic drum fill as well. You know, something so simple can become such a thing, a hook, you know.
I presume you've been at loads of gigs as well, or performing your own, but you've gone for Nina Simone as your favourite from the New Jersey Performing Arts Centre in August 1998. What's the story with that?
I was working as a doorman on the Upper East Side, J2 visa in New York, and Brian Nedball, the concierge, I was summer relief staff, and the whole summer I knew about this gig, and I really wanted to go, but because I was summer relief staff, I couldn't get the day off, and like 3 days, so I'd given up, and 3 days before the gig, Brian, who was very kind to me all summer, and he turned around and he goes, I got a surprise for you, Davey. He goes, I got you tickets for Nina, or whatever, and I was like, no. So get there, I am like, he didn't just get me tickets, he got me like like pretty much the best, you know, one of the best tickets. I was sitting directly behind Lauryn Hill and her her bodyguard in amongst these six incredible, you know, black women in an incredible African American dress, you know, with the headgear and all these beautiful kind of robes. And they somehow got it into their head that I'd come all the way from Ireland to see the gig or whatever. And it just became this thing, and they kept grabbing. There was so much tension. She hadn't played in the States for like 20 years, I think. And there was so much tension, and she came out and she was completely playing with the tension for the first 10 minutes. She kept starting and stopping this kind of spiritual. It was Sunday as well, so it really did have that kind of Sunday mass feel. And it was like, I got the spirit moves me. And she kept starting and stopping, and the women beside me were grabbing my legs and squeezed. They're going, oh my God, she, you know, everyone's trying to keep her on side because they knew how volatile she was. And then she stopped and she just said, I hate this country or whatever. And it was, the whole place just went into like the loudest kind of release of a cheer, like a kind of, yeah, we all hate it too. We love you, Nina, you know. And from there on, it just kind of like the big thing was her piano playing for the first, you know, the first half of the show. You're just like, wow, she's actually better on the piano than ever. You know, she just kept getting better. She evolves, and her voice took a while, but then it hit it, you know, it hit the note, and you're just like, wow, if that's all I get, then
that's it.
Yeah. But then she came out, I don't know, she may have had something to give her a little pep in her step in the interval, because she came out and she was doing all this kind of Vogue dancing and everything, and then she really had fun in the second half. And it was like quite a small kind of jazz, like upright bass, brush drums and a guitar player, very like the classic 70s recordings, you know. Yeah, and it's just hard, you know, it's hard, impossible to top that gig. Yeah, I've never seen anything like it.
Unfortunately, we don't have audio from that. We need to take a break. David Kitt, please stay with me for the second part of the Culture Club after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club. David Kitt is with us because next week you'll be able to get The Big Romance, 25th anniversary of the original release of the seminal LP, all re-recorded and with extra tracks on it as well. But let's get away from music, David, and let's talk about, we asked for a favourite movie, actor, director. You've given us Jonathan Glazer, who made The Zone of Interest, which I think is one of the best movies of the last decade, and also Under the Skin. Tell us a little bit about this choice.
Yeah, again, like Zone of Interest was one of those ones that took a while to digest, but it's so prescient with, you know, with what's happening in the world today in the likes of Palestine, where there's just, you know, things are happening right in plain sight, but somehow we all just kind of carry on with our lives, and the way he achieves it, and just even as an audio visual experience, the whole thing, like that bit in this middle where it's just this meditative space that Mika Levy does the music, and they also do the music for Under the Skin, which, yeah, when I saw that, I kind of remember seeing it in the IFI, and just, yeah, it's just one of those kind of
tell me more about it, because I don't know this movie.
Well, funnily enough, it's. I remember I had an experience. I was on a red eye flight. I was touring with David Gray in the States, and I had a New Jackson show in New York, which is quite a rare kind of jet setty thing to be happening to me. But I got on this flight from LA to New York, and I sat down beside this real jock kind of guy, and his partner kind of passed out, and he set himself up with the beers, and he was kind of muscled up and everything, and he thought he was watching, you know, a classic Scarlett Johansson film where, you know, he would be kind of titillated by her beauty or some, but little did he know that it was a kind of a, basically these aliens come to Glasgow and kind of abduct humans for their own reproductive purposes or whatever, and they go through this kind of elaborate, you know, extraction process. That's this. It's just so well, all the set design and the way that Scarlett Johansson is just out and about in Glasgow is actually really convincing. You know, it's like doesn't feel. It just, yeah, it works. And they're all on these kind of in these black leather clad motorcycle gang, And yeah, just the vulnerability of the humans who are kind of like, you know, she kind of abducts or whatever, and the sound design, everything about it, it's just got that Jonathan Glazer class.
Okay, I'm going to check that out under the skin. Favourite play? You've gone for Beckett's Waiting for Godot.
It's an obvious one, I suppose. I haven't really been to the theatre a hell of a lot, but I did see it in the Gate. I can't remember. I think it was Michael Gambon. Who else? But it's just one of those plays that you, to this day, you know, it's so part of like something like, I was thinking about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Is Dead recently, and, you know, so many, even Papillon, I watched the, you know, the last 30 minutes of Papillon is almost like there's a heavy Beckett influence, you know.
This presumably is the original version with Steve McQueen.
Yes, yeah.
Not the remake.
No. Is there a remake?
It was.
Really?
Yeah. Don't bother with
no.
the remake.
God, it's so good, the original. But yeah, it's just one of those things. I think it's the humor as well, you know, like it's just the absurdity of life and the kind of like sitting around waiting for nothing to happen and just the way it's executed, like with a wink, you know, like a very healthy wink. And I think it is the thing that people miss a lot in Beckett is that humor. It's quite a Dublin humor as well, I think. But I'm not saying people from the rest of the country can't get it, but I was at a talk once where I'm going to get into trouble. A Cork man was kind of going, I don't find that funny at all. Anyway, but it's very funny.
Favorite book and author?
Oh yeah, I've gone for The Brothers Karamazov. Like a lot of these are like early formative. Like maybe I just haven't.
With so many of our Culture Club guests.
Yeah,
it's things from their teens and twenties.
Yeah, yeah. Because I actually read The Brothers Karamazov the same summer I saw Nina Simone on that job on the night shift in this little capsule on upper, and maybe that's because I had 7-8 hours to kill, you know. I was keeping an eye on the security camera, but I managed to read Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, which it would be a miracle in my present life to get through that book. But
why so?
Just time, you know, time, concentration, just that, you know, just the bloody phone in the mix and social media, whatever it is, all the crap that we have to kind of seems to be part of our lives. But it stands up as, I think when I finished it, it's like, you know, the closest thing I've got to reading like the Old Testament or something. It's like, it's kind of all in there.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the opening of it.
Starting out on the biography of my hero, Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov, I find myself in some perplexity. Namely, that while I do call Alexei Fyodorovich my hero, still I myself know that he is by no means a great man, so that I can foresee the inevitable questions, such as, what is notable about your Alexei Fyodorovich that you should choose him for your hero? What has he really done? To whom is he known, and for what? Why should I, the reader, spend my time studying the facts of his life? This last question is the most fateful one, for I can only reply, perhaps you will see from the novel. But suppose they read the novel and do not agree with the noteworthiness of my Alexei Fyodorovich. I say this because, to my sorrow, I foresee it. To me, he is noteworthy, but I decidedly doubt that I shall succeed in proving it to the reader.
TV, you grew up, I see, with Neighbours, did you?
Yes, I am old enough that I, basically, when I was in primary school, Neighbours was only on during the day. You know, like it wasn't an evening show. It hadn't hit that peak yet. So we used to take turns in school pretending we were sick to go stay home and watch Neighbours. Well, you know, it was like you go tomorrow and fill in everyone on what was going on in Neighbours. It was like that would have been 11, you know. So, but you know, it's I was asked to choose something from my childhood, and it is like the, you know, I could have gone with Grange Hill or Rent a Ghost. There was a lot of good BBC TV around then, but yeah, Neighbours was like, you know, I did become emotionally involved.
Okay, and then your adult choice. We're going to play a little clip from this to see if people recognise this. Omar Little, played by Michael K. Williams, takes a stand in season two of this great TV series.
So you rob drug dealers. This is what you do.
Yes, sir.
You walk the streets of Baltimore with a gun, taking what you want when you want it, willing to use violence when your demands aren't met. This is who you are. Why should we believe your testimony then? Why believe anything you say?
That's up to y'all, really.
You say you aren't here testifying against the defendant because of any deal you made with police.
True that.
That you're here because you want to tell the truth about what happened to Mr. Gant in that housing project parking lot.
Yep.
When in fact you are exactly the kind of person who would, if you felt you needed to, shoot a man down on a housing project parking lot and then lie to the police about it, would you not?
Hey, look, I ain't never put my gun on no citizen.
You are a moral, are you not? You are feeding off the violence and the despair of the drug trade. You're stealing from those who themselves are stealing the lifeblood from our city. You are a parasite who leeches off
just like you,
the culture
man.
Of drugs. Excuse me? What?
I got the shotgun. We got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
The Wire. So, tell us about your love of this.
Well, that's one of the iconic quotes, isn't it? I've gone back to it again. I've gone back to it many times. I've like started on season two to mix it up a bit, or you know, just watch season four on its own. And even the last time I watched it, actually season five, surprised me that there's a bit more in it than I thought the first time round. It's just the character arcs. They really are like, you know, Shakespeare. They're at the level of that, like Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, like, you know, the kind, like Frank Sabatka in the one about the docks, the arc of his character, the tragedy of his life. It's just, it's something so poetic and perfect about it. And I actually got into The Wire through the books of George Pelicanus, like crime, Baltimore crime writer, like kind of gritty, a little bit Elmore Leonard, like an evolution of the Elmore Leonard type thing. And I saw that he was writing for the show and I was like, wow, this must be good. And actually the George Pelicanus episodes of The Wire are actually my favorite episodes.
We finish always with a cultural buried treasure. We thought you might give us something musical, but instead you've given us Anthony Cronin's Dead as Doornails.
Yeah, this I've read this a few times, and it was I was reminded of it in just kind of trying to think of something for this, because I gave away my own. I've gifted it to like five or six people. I find it so good. It's basically like the miracle is that Anthony Cronin remembers all this stuff, because they were like really, really. It was messy back then, as has been documented, I guess. But you know, Brendan Behan is the poster boy, I suppose, for the lifestyle. But like, you know, Breena Nolan, Flann O'Brien, Thomas Kinson, they were all getting involved. And it's just this incredible account of literary life back then, some of the bitchiness and competitiveness, but like the drinking and Nearies and sleep, you know, the digs underneath Nearies, like trips to Paris with one pair of jocks and, you know, like just falling off the boat and all sorts of, it's wild, you know, like it's really wild, a proper caper, like, and proper laugh out loud, like you really are just pissing yourself listening to this thing. It's incredible.
Anthony Cronin's Dead as Doornails, the cultural buried treasure of David Kitt. It's been great having you for the Culture Club. Thank you so much. The Big Romance will be available, the new 25th anniversary edition, will be re-recorded with additional tracks from next week.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.